consider FJR 1 non-CMS claims?
Senator Brown, members of the committee, Don Palat, Project Director of the Criminal Law Revision Commission, here to speak in behalf of Senate Joint Resolution 1, which has been proposed by the Criminal Law Revision Commission. I hope I can make my comments quite brief, in as much as I think that the commentary that we have set forth and now in your yellow book, this appears as an appendix on page 304, and the commentary there too on pages 304 and 305. Essentially what this proposal is meant to do, although it does read considerably differently from the existing constitutional provision, is to deal with the grand jury provisions. You'll notice that in the existing section, as well as the proposal that we're suggesting under SJR 1, that there are other matters dealt with in that section. For example, selecting juries and qualifications of jurors, drawing and summoning grand jurors from the regular jury list at any time, impaneling more than one grand jury in a county, the sitting of a grand jury, etc. Those matters are not meant to be changed. We have restructured the form of the section and broken it down into subsections to make it easier to read and to distinguish one part from another. But the real heart of this proposal appears in subsections 3, 4, and 5, which are new provisions. Now, sub 3 provides that except as provided in subsections 4 and 5, a person shall be charged in a circuit court with the commission of any crime punishable as a felony only on indictment by a grand jury. The existing language talks about crimes or misdemeanors. We have deleted any reference in here to misdemeanors, with the intent being that misdemeanors would be chargeable under statutory provisions, even in circuit court, by a district attorney's information without a grand jury indictment or a waiver of indictment. But with respect to crimes that are punishable as a felony, in other words, what would be under the criminal code a Class C felony or above, that, or if it were some statute located in a regulatory provision of ORS that has the old type of so-called indictable misdemeanor penalty provision that would leave the to the option of the court to treat a crime upon conviction as either a felony or a misdemeanor, that for the purposes of this proposal would be considered a crime punishable as a felony and would be chargeable only on indictment. However, the two new provisions under 4 and 5 would authorize the district attorney to charge a person on information filed in circuit court of a crime punishable as a felony if the person appears before the judge of the circuit court and knowingly waives indictment. That's existing provision. The optional provision that we're proposing, and I would say at this point that this is very similar to House Joint Resolution 12, which was before the 1971 session of the legislature, and we allude to that in our commentary to our proposal. And just as an aside, would call your attention to the fact that that measure did pass the House by a substantial vote, 45-11, and narrowly failed in the Senate, 16-14. But sub 5 does differ from HJR 12 in that we would allow the district attorney to charge on an information after a preliminary hearing before a magistrate, if the person has been held to answer upon a showing of probable cause that a crime punishable has been committed and that the person has committed it. Now, that language was not in H.J.R. 12, and we think that this proposal is a better proposal for that reason, because it would make it a matter of constitutional law under the Oregon Constitution that such a showing would be required. We think as a matter of United States constitutional law that it would probably be required in any event if we were going to charge directly in circuit court on a district attorney's information. But what this is meant to do, and also we have written in the other option which the defendant would have of knowingly waiving his preliminary hearing. But it does write in a probable cause test with respect to this preliminary hearing. Now, what would happen if this measure is approved by the legislature and goes to a vote of the people and is adopted, is that the district attorney would have the option, after any of the events that occurred under subsection 5, of proceeding directly into circuit court on a district attorney's information, which we have defined, as you know, in the criminal procedure code. We think that the run-of-the-mill felony cases, based upon statements made to the commission by the district attorneys who sat in with us, and also based on discussions that were held in the Bar Committee, the Oregon State Bar Committee on Criminal Law, as well as statements made before the legislature last session in support of H.J.R. 12, that in the run-of-the-mill cases, the district attorneys would undoubtedly opt for the felony information rather than going to the grand jury. We think that this will make the system more flexible. It will eliminate the unnecessary taking of routine cases, even though they are felonies, to the grand jury without depriving the defendant of the requirement of a prima facie showing before a magistrate, and consequently, in most cases, that since you are eliminating a needless step of going to a grand jury, that you can get to trial faster. It would save the grand jury time, it would save prosecutors time, and also, of course, if we're saving time, presumably we're saving money. Now, I want to make it clear that this proposal does not bind the district attorney to go into circuit court on an information. We discussed that as an alternative proposal in the commission and rejected that idea. We feel that even though there has been a bind over and there's been a showing of probable cause, that the posture of a case could change, or that the bind over may be on a, as a result of the showing that's made at the preliminary hearing, may be as a result of a failure of a witness to show up, for example, or some other defect that could be cured later before a grand jury, that it would be unfair to commit the district attorneys to an either-or proposition. But we are persuaded that it would be an option that would be used in most cases. However, this does not eliminate the grand jury. It does not take away any of the investigatory powers of the grand jury. But it certainly, we think, would make the system much more flexible. It is a system that has worked in other states. It is, in some states, of course, there are no grand juries. The federal constitution does not require a grand jury. The case law is clear on that. This is a matter of state option. And as you know, originally in this state, we had no grand jury. This was left up to the legislature in the original Oregon Constitution. we think this is a good middle position to make the system flexible and at the same time protect the interests of any defendant. But we don't think that as a matter of practice that there is anything to be gained by requiring a grand jury indictment or even a waiver in a misdemeanor charge, even though it is in circuit court.
Questions to Mr. Peta?
Yes.
Senator Cook.
Don, isn't the leaving the grand jury in here really kind of a hollow shell? It's really going to be meaningless, generally, under the proposed amendment, isn't it? As far as the question of preferring a charge against the person.
Well, you mean meaningless from the standpoint of the defendant or from the standpoint of the system?
Both. Really kind of a, trying to think of the tail that we have, something that's left in there.
Yeah. Well, Senator Cook, I think, first of all, from the standpoint of the defendant, it was the view on the commission, and I think practically a unanimous view, except there was at least one member of the commission who felt that we should just propose to abolish the grand jury, period. But certainly, by and large, the overwhelming view of the Criminal Law Revision Commission members is that from the standpoint of the defendant, for the run-of-the-mill felony case, that the grand jury does not offer the protection that in a romantic and classical sense one has, at least from a layman's point of view, one would think the grand jury offers, that we felt that as a practical matter, although the district attorneys we heard from, in fact, the district attorney who was a member of the commission, Don Blensley, indicated that it was his practice to just present the case to the grand jury and let the grand jury make up its own mind. The way that the district attorneys handle this varies from one county to the next in certain degrees, but as a practical matter, I think as a fact of life that the commission members recognize, and I think most district attorneys would agree to this, that if the district attorney has a strong enough case that he thinks that he should have an indictment, that he is going to get an indictment. And but at the same time, it's difficult to generalize, and because you can't anticipate all kinds of factual situations in which you may have a case in which the district attorney feels that maybe there should be an indictment and maybe there shouldn't, and he wants to be able to present this to the body of the seven grand jurors and see what their reaction is to it. And so I don't think it's a hollow shell from that standpoint, although as I said, I don't think that a defendant is protected by the grand jury procedure as was originally intended. Because district attorneys with their heavy caseloads are just not going to mess around with a weak case taken into the grand jury. They just won't go that far with it in 9 out of 10 cases. From the standpoint of the system, however, I don't think it's a hollow shell to leave this option in there for the kind of case that may change its posture from the time, say, an information or a complaint is filed originally charging a defendant, say, in district court, which would then set in motion the machinery that would lead to a preliminary hearing. We don't think it's a hollow shell from that standpoint, because the case as it comes out of the preliminary hearing may be a far different case than the district attorney is going to be able to present to the grand jury at some subsequent time. If we lock the DAs into automatically requiring them to file an information, then for all practical purposes, they're committed. They're committed to their case as it stands at the time of the original charge that's filed in the lower court. So I think procedurally it is not hollow. I hope that answers.
I just wondered if it just doesn't preserve one of the shortcomings, supposedly, of the present grand jury system, and that is that it doesn't really place the responsibility on the attorney. If he gets a hot potato, he can submit it to the grand jury.
Yeah, that's true. I agree, it does. It leaves that there. A hot potato case that the district attorney wants to present to the grand jury, for whatever reason, he would be able to do so under this proposal. That's
on the other
true.
Hand, I kind of have the feeling, and as you know, I always oppose the amendment, that the main protection we're concerned about is the political protection, really, or the kind of case that perhaps not the run of the mill. We're concerned about the abuse. And that's where the grand jury, perhaps, in the classical sense, might actually be a protection to the individual. The only case I know of involved exactly that. I remember citing last time that we discussed this. The county judge in Washington County was charged with absconding with some heart problems by a test. And he managed to go before the grand jury and either not prove it.
Yeah. Well, of course, I think there's another thing that we have to keep in mind, and that is not all charges are going to be initiated through a charge being filed in a lower court, in district court or justice court.
Senator John Burns?
Don, it's been a while since we handled this on the commission, and I think I missed some of those meetings. But we preserve the right, just to rattle it off, because I missed the first part of your presentation. We preserve the discovery process inherent in the preliminary hearing, notwithstanding the fact that we're also proposing greatly increased discovery. So be charged in circuit court by information until you've been bound over or until you've waived. So the defendant is continued to avail himself of the discovery procedure in a preliminary hearing, right? Okay. Now, if after he's bound over and he wants to go to the grand jury, you know, and I've discussed this, I discussed in the commission, I had a policeman that was in trouble and he wanted to go to the grand jury, and we took a lie detector test in with us and it was washed out. I had a homicide case once, the same thing. But if he wants to go to the grand jury, he's been bound over, first degree or murder, homicide. And I go to the DA and I said, I think this is a case that that we ought to try in the grand jury. There's nothing to prevent the DA from saying, okay, John, we'll put it in, right?
Right.
But he's not bound to. In other words, the defendant can't elect to go.
No.
Okay, but there's nothing to prevent the DA from saying, okay, John, we'll put it in the grand jury. Okay.
That's right.
But after he's bound over or after he waived, then you proceed against him in circuit court by information. Now, I forget, in what instance do you have to go the grand jury route under this? In what instance? I mean, we keep the grand jury, and I assume if there's a policeman that shot, or a policeman shoots somebody, let's put it that way, if the district attorney goes to put the case in the grand jury.
Well,
But in what case, instance, does it have to go to the grand jury?
Well, in no instance does it have to go to the grand jury under this proposal. But there are instances in which it would, practically speaking, go to the grand jury because, as I indicated earlier, not all charges are going to be initiated through a charge, a district attorney's information being filed in lower court. Some charges are going to come directly out of the grand jury.
Oh, secret indictment. Yeah.
You know.
Oh, right.
And of course, it's, and we felt it was important to leave that option in there, that, that not all cases are going to be initiated this way. And some of the cases, of course, just like they are now, are going to go to the grand jury and be washed out in the grand jury. But if I could, Senator, I'd also like to comment with respect to the expanded pretrial discovery that's proposed under the under Senate Bill 80, which the district attorneys have already indicated that by and large they support with reservations about some specific sections perhaps, but any defense attorney will tell you, I think, that a preliminary hearing is a very poor discovery device. And we would expect that as a matter of practice, that if the defense attorney who is now using the preliminary hearing as a discovery device has the expanded right to discovery of the state's case under the article we're proposing here, that as a practical matter, you would probably have more waivers of preliminary hearing.
Right.
So that once the waiver is executed, then the district attorney would have the option to take it into the circuit court.
Okay,
but he would still be required to provide the discovery.
I'd agree. I'd agree. Of course, when we had HJR 12 on the floor in 71, we didn't have a discovery, a proposed change in the discovery rules, so if we'd have voted for that, we would have given up the discovery that we get under preliminary hearing.
You mean
and
discovery that discovery already talked about?
Well, the discovery value that you get out of examining the state's witnesses at the preliminary hearing.
Well, under that measure, it didn't make any provision for being bound over by the magistrate at all?
Oh, and now HJR 12 did.
Oh,
yes.
Did it?
Yeah, HJR 12 did provide, did require the bind over, did require preliminary hearing, but it didn't write in the probable cause test that we write in here under our subsection 5. But it did require, and as I recall, the way it came out of the Senate committee as amended required either a preliminary hearing or a waiver of a preliminary hearing. And from that point on, the district attorney would have the option, just as he would under our proposal.
Does this stand alone, or are you saying that it's companion to Senate Bill 80 and Michigan?
Well, I think it's companion. Yes, it is.
It should be held until 80 passes.
Well,
we
heard that.
The
approval.
It's a companion measure. One is not necessarily contingent upon the passage of the other, but we feel that this is an important recommendation that should be submitted to the people, and that we have allowed for the statutory provisions to implement the changes we contemplate in here. That is an expanded use of the district attorney's information in circuit court.
Senator Hoyt.
You mentioned that if the district attorney had a poor case, he'd go right to the judge for the information instead of going to the grand jury. Is that because to save time?
Well, no.
If he had a strong case, he would use the grand jury.
No, I didn't say that, Senator Hoyt. I didn't mean to leave that impression. What I did say was that if the district attorney has a strong enough case to get an indictment, and he feels that the defendant that he is suggesting should be indicted under our existing system that as a practical matter, the grand jury is going to indict that defendant.
Why would he want to take all the time and expense to do that? If he's got a good case, why would he go right to the judge and use the information about
it? Well, he can't do it now under the existing constitutional requirements.
I thought you were talking about under the new proposal.
No, under the new proposal, I would expect the district attorneys, at least the ones we heard from in the commission, although I'm not sure whether the DA's Association has taken a position on HJR or on SJR 1, I would expect that they would, by and large, support what we're suggesting, and that is to give them more flexibility.
They use the information rather than accept the cop-outs and the studies.
Let them use the information for the run-of-the-mill cases, but still preserve the grand jury for those cases that, as I indicate, may change posture from the time you have the preliminary hearing between that time and when you want to go to trial in circuit court.
You mean stalling?
No, I don't mean stalling. I mean that things can happen that a district attorney at a preliminary hearing may, through no fault of his own, and be unable to produce a critical witness. And that as a result, instead of a bindover or the magistrate holding the defendant to answer on a felony charge, he feels that based on the evidence heard at the preliminary hearing, there's not sufficient evidence to hold the defendant on the felony charge, but he would hold him to answer on a lesser charge. The commission believed that we should not lock the district attorney in at that point. In other words, if he has a felony case that he can present to the grand jury, that he should still retain that option. We're not suggesting that cases be tried and disposed of at the preliminary hearing. We're suggesting that before the DA have this option, that the defendant have the right to require the district attorney to make this prima facie case before a magistrate, and that as a practical matter, this is going to offer the defendant the same, if not more, protection than he has under the current existing grand jury system.
Senator John Burns?
No, I just had an example last week which would have fit in, but that I ruled with, and I just want to explain it.
Further questions for Mr. Pena? Judge Brantrill, would you stay here, Don? And Judge Brantrill, would you join us, please?
Thank you. I'm Ed Branchfield, speaking only for Ed Branchfield. I personally think that this would be a good improvement in our criminal law and in the procedures. I would call attention to sub 6. The second sentence, district attorney may file an amended indictment or information whenever by ruling of the court it is held to be defective in form. And if I understand my old high school grammar, it would have to refer back to something else. The only thing it can refer to is either amended indictment or information. And I would suggest that there be a revision of that sentence. I mean, we all know what's meant to be said by it, but it is a poor sentence structure. And I'd suggest that there be an amendment. Also, I assume that this would be intended to give the district attorney an authority to file an amended indictment. At least that's what it says. I'm sure that it is meant that he can file an amended indictment without going back to the grand jury. But in view of the fact that question can come up, I thought I'd better mention it now.
Have to resubmit and get a new return.
This would make it sound as though he could file an amended indictment without going back to the grand jury. And if that is not what's intended, then that change also be.
That's a good point.
Questions for Judge
Branchfield?
Judge
Branchfield,
would you stay here, Don? Would you like to comment?
Well, yes, I would. the existing language says that any district attorney may file an amended indictment whenever an indictment has, by a ruling of the court, been held to be defective in form. We used pronoun it here to indicate both an information or indictment. In other words, we felt that if we're going to encourage the expanded use of the information, that
yeah,
the
but amended modifies both indictment and information, and yet it goes to amended, which is incorrect grammar.
It'd be like a pending indictment or something.
If the indictment or the information is
no. I see. That point's well taken, Senator. I would agree with that.
But then the second point was that it go back to the grand jury, or are you contending that the DA can file the amended indictment without going to grand?
Well, the statutory provisions on that with respect to amending think would control
the
Constitution.
The foreman has to sign it again, though.
The Constitution now doesn't say how he does this. The statutes say procedurally what he has to do, and we would continue that this be done through the procedural statutes, the manner in which you do this.
No, I did not, Madam Chairman.
What would the feeling of the commission? Should it have to resubmit the indictment to the grand jury, or he could amend it?
Would be a subsequent change.
Well, I'll have to refresh my recollection on chapter 132.
Usually these are technical things. They don't have anything to do with the evidence that gone before the grand jury.
Well, I think the girl just retypes it, the foreman re-signs it, and you submit it. But I don't think the case doesn't have to do that.
But John,
I could comment, Madam Chairman. I think if I were a district attorney in Harney County and I was going to charge somebody, I would take it to grand jury if I wanted to be reelected. I think they'll continue to use it.
Other comments or questions?
If I can get back to the, there are provisions in the code that would provide for the court allowing the case to be resubmitted or refiled. And those are in the article on, it's Article 9 under pleadings, where you have a number of motions provided for and the effect of the allowance of the motions from sections, now this in your yellow book, sections 272, 273, 274, and 275. We're talking about a motion to set aside the indictment or to dismiss the accusatory instrument, which, and here again I would point out we've used the language accusatory instrument, which is defined in the code to include an information. Then if you'll notice under section 274, the effect of the allowance of the motion, under the new language proposed in subsection 2, of amended ORS 135.530, we say that if the court allows the case to be resubmitted or refiled, by the state, it must be submitted within 30 days from the date in which the court enters the order. Now, we use the language resubmitted or refiled. Resubmitted, talking about an indictment. Refiled, anticipating a use of an information that, and if we're talking about just technical corrections that have to be made in the accusatory instrument, then as a practical matter, we wouldn't anticipate any great difficulty under either the information or indictment system any more than you have now under under an indictment that's been ruled to be defective for one reason or another. And
I had a question.
Why don't we change that last sentence in subsection 6 to read, if by ruling of the court, the accusatory instrument is held to be defective before the district attorney may file an amended accusatory?
6 of the proposed constitutional amendment.
Mm-hmm. That would take care of it.
Well, we've got the indictment and the information above.
Well, why isn't this consistent with the new code?
Well, because accusatory instrument includes complaint, and here for the purposes of circuit court we would not propose that you file a complaint in circuit court. It'd have to be either an information or an indictment.
Well, anyway, I think you'd have better language to turn this around and seeing what the district attorney
is
going to do after the
yes I think that room. That objection is well taken.
Further questions of these gentlemen? Thank you, Judge Granger.
Thank you very much.
Senate Bill 132. Did anybody else want to be held or heard for this? Anybody else here on SJR 1? Okay, Senate Bill 132, Mr. Enfield.
I'm supposed to testify in the House later. I'll be right back.
Okay.
Senator Brown, members of the committee, I'm Myron Enfield. I'm a practicing lawyer, practicing in Salem, Oregon. I'm here on behalf of Senate Bill 132, on behalf of the Oregon State Bar in that regard. This is a bill to amend ORS 12.090, which deals with mutual accounts. The case of Vanderweil versus Koch, 90 Advance Sheets, 1953 and 1970 case is the basis for this suggested amendment.
90 Advance Sheets, 1953?
Yes, the specific citation is 472 Pacific 2nd, 803. And in that...
Name again, please.
Vanderweil, W-A-N-D-E. Capital W-I-E-L-E. And the statute as it now stands, ORS 12.090, refers to mutual accounts. And I think the general consensus amongst the members of the public, the bar, judiciary was that this was simply an extension of credit on one side. However, it's plain from the language of the Vanderweil case that a mutual account is one where I sell you rock salt and you sell me lumber or something like that, and we both extend credit. I have a feeling that this bill, I mean this statute as it originally stands, has more relevance today when the farmer brought in eggs and poultry and things of that sort to his grocer and took home sugar and flour and things of this sort, where there was an extension of credit in the normal course of business. An extension of credit on both sides is, I think, relatively infrequent at the present time.
So you're going to change it so there's just extension of credit on one side?
That's
or
right.
Both.
That's right.
The other.
That's right. And I might say that it would run from the last charge or payment proved in the account, and this last charge or payment would not include financing charges, carrying charges, or interest, or things of this sort. It simply eliminates the mutuality and the reciprocal demand. I think it makes the law what most of us thought the law always was, whether we're lawyers or businessmen, debtors or creditors. I believe it would be a add clarity to the law and eliminate certain confusion that presently exists.
Question to Mr. Enfield. Senator White?
Is there no reference in the present commercial code to an ordinary account about the fund time?
I do not believe there is anything in the present commercial code as to when the statute of limitations starts to run. Certainly was not referred to in the Vanderweil case, as I recall.
Did they ever get that big job through without having some... This is a major
our great business concern. How did that, was that wrapped up? And here you pick up some old language about trading eggs for butter and hay, and I just can't believe that wasn't in the new commercial code that we were so proud of.
Well, because it's part of the commercial code.
Why isn't it?
It essentially deals with the statute of limitations, or I should say really exclusively deals with the statute of limitations problem.
Well, to some extent, but not as it relates to the running of statute.
Sort of thing, it could have been in the code and it doesn't have to be, you know, I suppose there are statute of limitations set forth in the commercial code for some things, but it really isn't an essential part of the scheme of the commercial code.
Would it include notes? Something like that?
This would not include, would not refer to notes, and I am sure that that's right. I'm sure that notes and number of things of that nature are covered in the commercial code.
I do want to ask a question now, Chair.
Senator John Burns.
All right. I just had this similar issue in front of Judge Bologna. Assume that you and I signed a note in 1960 for X number of dollars. Today is 73. You paid interest punctually every 6 months for that whole period of time, right up to whenever within the statutory period. Under this, the payment of that interest wouldn't toll the running of the statute, and the note would be outlawed in 1966, right?
No, I do not believe so, for two reasons.
Okay.
This involves mutual accounts. Our note is not included in that category. All secondly...
All right, let's change it then. It's an account. I have I sell you merchandise on an account in 1960.
All right. I do not believe that this would be included for the reason that it would be a payment upon the note. Now, what we're referring to in that last sentence is that you cannot be running your store and simply by tacking on that 1.5% charge each month extend to infinity the running of the statute of limitations.
Okay, but if you were paying me the interest, then that would toll it.
That's right.
Okay. Well, then it doesn't substantially change.
And not in that regard, I'm not sure it does.
Further questions?
I think that I've researched that mutual open and current and up one side and down the other, and I think it's a hell of a lot more simple. Just use it for that.
Thank you, Mr. Enfield. Does anybody else wish to be heard on Senate Bill 130? Oh, Mr. Enfield, this was passed by the Bar Convention.
Yes, it was. Yes.
Thank you.
Do you want a motion on this bill?
Is there anyone else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 132? Is it the consensus of the committee or adjourned?
I move that we send Senate Bill 132 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion. Clerk call roll. Aye.
This is another bill that was submitted by the Practice and Procedure Committee of the Oregon State Bar, of which I am a member. It was approved by the Oregon State Bar at their annual meeting in the fall of 1972. It proposes an amendment of ORS 17.320. It is Senate Bill 133. the present time, the pleadings in a case, which are generally a complaint, answer, reply, and sometimes possibly other pleadings, go to the jury by virtue of ORS 17.320. I think many of us practicing law look forward to this, and we put in some rather flowery and highly descriptive adjectives. We never have simply an injury, it's always a grievous injury. Never simply have a collision, it's always a violent collision, it seems. And you can go on and on with the adjectives. I think this causes numerous motions to strike these matters by opposing attorneys because they know that this pleading is going to the jury and they desire to get this language out of the pleading. The effect of Senate Bill 133 would simply be to not require the judge to send the pleadings to the jury. It would not change any other documents that go to the jury room. And I believe the entire membership of the Practice and Procedure Committee believes that this would eliminate a number of motions and as a consequence would speed up the judicial process, possibly save some judicial time. Would not require the judge to send the pleadings to the jury.
Okay. Madam Chairman?
Senator John Burns.
Yeah, right. You mean you want to take the pleadings away from the jury?
That's correct. Not necessarily take them away, but when they retire to deliberate, to not to send the pleadings with them.
And this passed unanimously out of Practice and Procedure Committee?
My memory that it did, but perhaps I could stand corrected. It passed, but I frankly do not have a memory of whether it was had any substantial opposition or not, Chair.
Question to Mr. Enfield. Senator Keith Burns.
Well, this isn't part of what your bill is going to do. It seems like we ought to pass it, but we're going to do something else, right? Depositions that were exhibits. The reason why I say this is because when that Sutton case came down where anybody can write a statement about what happened and that can be substantive evidence. So a guy could write a whole book about the accident and under that ruling by college, why that could be dumped into substantive evidence. It seems to me like depositions would counter something. That's a very unfortunate ruling.
I'm inclined to agree with you, Senator Burns, and I have some personal feelings about the matter of changing that deposition portion of the same statute, but that's not a part of the bill.
Well, may I make a statement and let Mr. Enfield respond? It seems to me that it's a great assistance to the jury when you get up in your opening statement, and I don't care whether you're prosecuting or defending a criminal case or plaintiffing or defending a civil case, if there's flowery language in there that wasn't stricken or wasn't moved against, then it's counsel's fault or the court's fault. But it seems to me that it's a great assistance to the jury, particularly in a complicated case, to be able to read the allegations and it's an assistance to counsel in arguing the case and pointing out. Now, look, when you go into the jury room, look at that complaint. And the second allegation contends that there was lookout. And I'm amazed. There's some pretty good lawyers on your committee, and I'm amazed that they... How do they counter that argument? They want the jury to be in the dark?
No, I don't think they want the jury to be in the dark, but they're of the opinion that the instructions and the statements of the court, as well as counsel's argument, will fill that in. I've been there myself and used pleadings and had them used against me,
right.
Both on both plaintiff's and defendant's side. I don't think it's a plaintiff's bill or a defendant's bill. I believe it's simply the feeling of the attorneys that sending the pleadings to the jury serve no useful purpose, and because they ultimately are going to the jury under the present statute, that you have to file these motions, which do take up additional time for parties and for the court, really serve no purpose.
These motions?
Motions to strike some of this flowery language. You've seen it.
You mean in the at the outset?
Yes, at the outset.
Further
questions?
Thank you. I'd like to ask a general question about this. I don't understand. The only times I've been on a jury, we were never able to take anything, even the judge's instructions in writing, and we had to spend it pretty on our memory. Is that customary, or are we talking about the same thing here?
We are not talking about the same thing. Now, there's a Senate Bill 138 coming up, I believe, immediately after this, dealing with instructions. I do not believe that instructions go to the jury unless one part or the other requests it at the outset of the trial, and then all instructions have to be in writing.
Well, the point, I guess, is it looks like nobody cares, but worry about the jury doing a good job. This ordinary memory, some of these things are so complicated that they over a day or two you can forget half of what you're supposed to remember. And it looks like this. I don't know what's about this, but it looks like this is part of my problem if I were on a jury again.
I believe that the things that go to the jury at the present time are the pleadings and all of the exhibits that are in evidence.
They can take any of their own notes, though, can't
they? Oh, yes, they can take any notes that they make themselves, as I remember none that anybody else makes.
Other questions?
I just asked them just to reaffirm the feeling that I had. They can take their own notes. And I thought for Senator Hoyt's benefit.
Should Senator Hoyt is there anybody else who wants to be heard on Senate Bill 133? Then let's turn to Senate Bill 138.
Senate Bill 138 is another bill written by the Practice and Procedure Committee of the Oregon State Bar and passed by the annual meeting in the fall of 72. It is to amend ORS 17.255. At the present time, in a trial of a jury case, the court gives all of the instructions in regard to the law pertaining to the case to the jury orally, unless at the outset of the trial one party or the other gives notice that he desires that the instructions be in writing. If either party so moves, or the court may do it on its own motion, then the instructions are given to the jury, and the law says without any oral explanation or addition. This amendment would allow the court to give the jury some oral explanation or some oral addition to the written instructions if he felt it was proper. At the present time, he cannot. It would also require the court to read the entire written instructions to the jury as well as give them to them. In other words, the court could make oral additions to them, could read the written instructions to them, and then when the jury retired to deliberate, the jury would take the written instructions with them to the jury room to use in their deliberation. As the law now stands, the trial court cannot make any oral explanation or addition to these written instructions. We believe the court should have this right.
Senator Bernicott.
Why?
Because I believe that when you write written instructions, it is absolutely, I shouldn't say absolutely, that's too strong, but I will say that in the overpowering percentage of cases, it is impossible to write instructions. Each side is submitting their own, and I suggest that it's extremely difficult, if not impossible, for the court to compile a set of written instructions that is entirely complete as the case goes to the jury. I think this would give the court that discretion to make such oral explanations or additions as are required. And I think the present language of the statute is that the court gives them to the jury, does not read them, but simply gives them, which I also think.
Madam Chairman, I had a case like this once, which was a complicated case, and the other attorney requested written instructions, and it was long, and the jury got confused, and they sent a note out, and they wanted the judge to explain the instructions, and Judge Griffin said, well, I can't under the statute, and later some of the jurors had a terrible fight because they didn't all have time to read all of them, and somebody was trying to explain them to them, and they came back about three different times to ask the judge to explain the written instructions. I think it's a good bill because, as I understand it, they would take the written instructions in with them,
yeah.
But if they had a question, they could have that orally explained by the court.
That's right.
Senator Ivers.
Was.
Yes, did I understand you to say that he could explain written instructions under the proposal?
Under the proposal, he could make such additional explanation as he felt proper and within the law.
Well, that isn't the way I read it. The way I read it says to read to him as written, and you've deleted the words, which might indicate it, but it just says read to him as written. Is this broad enough to allow him to explain them? I think he should be allowed to explain, but I don't know whether it's broad enough to include that.
Do you have an interesting question, actually. One would think, having taken this out, that the court looked back, they'd say that you could have an oral explanation, but you could have the other interpretation that the senator suggests.
Well, I suppose that you could have the other decision by the court, but as it stands now, the court certainly cannot give an oral explanation. I think taking that out would...
You think it would, even though it says as written, that would still allow him to explain it?
Right.
Well, Senator Keith Burns.
Well, I think I'm concerned about this. First place, I think a lot of circuit court judges have never knew the statute existed. And
a lot of lawyers.
When you're settling instructions in a case, some kind of a technical issue here, you want to get an instruction and finally a little give and take and so forth, you get down to the instructions. Well, that judge gets through by first you start it all over again, and you really don't get the same input there that you did with the instructions. You wanted it, you're going to argue the thing, and so you've argued on that instruction, and then it comes time to give again. Like a lot of sand can pull from under you when they get to explaining it.
Yes.
I kind of like to know what they're going to say and mean at that point.
I understand you to say that you still intend them to give them the jury the written instructions to take with them. And if you're taking out the word given, I would assume the court would interpret it that he could not give them the written instructions.
I believe the last sentence, Madam Chairman, the jury shall take such written instructions with it while deliberating upon the verdict and return them to the clerk immediately upon conclusion of deliberations.
So the sentence before includes that too, given to the jury.
Yes.
Okay.
I'd like to ask
Senator Hoyt,
what would you think about an amendment here that permitted the jury to request the written instructions before they retired?
I think ideally, Senator, that would be good. But as a practical matter, I think it might very well be impossible, because when you start a case, if one side or the other gives a notice that they're going to require written instructions, if we started the trial this morning and the other side gave in such a notice, I would have probably tonight to work on those instructions. But if the attorney's got this request as the case was going to the jury, then I think it might be a serious practical question of how you could get these written up to submit.
The attorney's got to approve of the judge's.
Essentially, what happens is that the attorneys on each side will write the instructions that they want the judge to give. The judge will sift through them and say, I like these from this side, and these are all right from this side, and in effect, make up his own book. But by the time you had attorneys on each side writing them, and then the judge going through them, I believe it would probably be an impractical.
Well, I guess I was talking about the wrong bill, because this certainly doesn't my point. Nobody gives a damn what about the jury, and assuming that the jurors are trying to do a conscious job, they got to have crutches. They got to know what they heard and remember it, or how many days sometimes.
I think probably ought to be more trial lawyers here to listen to you, Senator. Say,
well, I would think that you ought to require that the instructions be given to the jury.
If they're written.
Judge
Branchfield, you look like you've got something to say.
I don't think I have any comments on this one, Madam Chairman. Thank you.
Further questions
of
Mr. Enfield? Thank you, Mr. Enfield. Oh, just a minute. Is there anybody else here that wants to be heard on Senate Bill 138? I'm not sure the Senate Bill 140.
Procedure code in ORS Chapter 19 with respect to cross appeals. It's drafted by the Committee on Procedure and Practice and Procedure of the Oregon State Bar and approved at the 1972 bar meeting. Basically, the bill is intended to clarify Chapter 19 by making it clear that a party can cross appeal against a party other than the appellant in multi-party litigation. An example is given on the first page of the statement of the situation in which this question might arise. About the middle of the first page here, where A sues two defendants for personal injuries, gets a judgment against only one of them. The defendant held liable appeals, the plaintiff cross appeal against the other party, against C, who was not held liable, and yet he may want to hold him liable.
There was a case where this actually happened. Like I read a case where this was involved. Without a luck, as far as I see.
Could be. The statement does not indicate that the situation has actually arisen, at least in a reported Oregon case. It has arisen, I think, in cases outside the state of Oregon. Possibly it has more recently. I don't know. Another possibility for this might come into play is under our cross-claim practice that recently adopted, the legislature has, where one defendant may cross-claim against another. You can conceive of a situation where the plaintiff sues two defendants. One defendant cross-claims for indemnity in the event he is held liable. The judgment goes against the plaintiff. He appeals against, let's say, both defendants, but the cross-claim is dismissed because they don't reach it, because the plaintiff was thrown out of court. The cross-claiming defendant might want to preserve by protective cross-appeal, his right to continue seeking indemnity in the event A succeeds on his appeal and gets the case reinstated. So I think this bill is simply intended to make clear that this can be done in the statute. The statute's a little ambiguous at the moment. It possibly could be interpreted that way.
You can cross-claim it. You can cross-claim against co-defendants, cross-appeal against the co-defendants, but not cross-appeal against the plaintiff. Is that right? And 71 passed.
You're talking about cross-claims now.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm looking at the bottom of page 2, Carl.
Of the bill?
Yeah, no, of your statement.
Yes.
Cross 16315 allows a defendant to make cross claims against a co-defendant.
Correct. And that's what I was alluding to. You might cross claim for indemnity, and let's say that cross claim is dismissed because the plaintiff was denied recovery against anybody. Therefore, the indemnity claim was not reached. Plaintiff appeals, succeeds, comes back. If the defendant who's seeking a cross-claim for indemnity has not preserved by a protective cross-appeal his right to continue that claim for indemnity, he might be out of court when the case comes back down.
And 73A permits this in the federal
case? Yes, I believe so.
Question to Mr. Neal.
Madam Chairman, one typographical error on the bill. Page 3 of the bill, line 9, says a notice to all the adverse, to all parties of their attorneys. I'm quite sure that should be or their attorneys.
I have a question.
Senator.
It's not a question to the thrust of your bill, but it's a section that I had intimate acquaintance with is in here. And that's just section 3, where under the current law, the notice of appeal must contain not only the matter in A, B, and C, but also D and E. And rather famous case. I left off some of this and realized this was the law. The court held that the D and E was not essential, even though it wasn't in, you could correct it. But I just wonder if this wasn't carrying a little bit, this speedy processing of things a little bit too far to require the designation of proceedings and plain and concise statement of points in this notice of appeal. And if the former law, which permitted the notice of appeal to be filed, and then it said within so many days, I don't recall now how much it was, maybe Ed remembers, you had the right then to file your designation of record and statement of points. Now it seems to me that's more sensible than to require all this to be done at the time of filing the notice of appeal.
Can I make a brief comment on that?
Yes, would you, Judge Branchfield, would you come up?
Well, I, of course, was very much aware of the problem Senator Cook had. My own...
came out all right.
I'm glad of that. He relied on me for legal advice. I sure have been in a bad spot if it hadn't worked. I have been telling the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court for 3 years that the old provisions relating to a designation of record and even the new ones are a trap, or at least that many lawyers think they're a trap and you waste time on them. And sometimes you have an awful lot of agony like Senator Cook had. It seems to me that it would be appropriate to leave these in here, but if I were doing it my way, I would also provide that it is not expressly, I mean, even though you have Senator Cook's case to rely on, I provide expressly that the appellant does not lose his rights if for some reason he doesn't include these, or if for some reason he later on determines that in order to make a complete appeal, he needs to refer to something else. And this is what's always troubled me, that you throw in everything, including the kitchen sink, because you want to be sure you get everything and not overlook it. I think that many times you'd have much shorter transcripts if the attorneys had a real opportunity to look and submit only what they really want, and then know that they're not going to be mousetrapped and not bring it in again.
Well, the federal rules provide for the filing of supplemental points. Now, can't you file supplemental points in our appellate procedure?
Well, this doesn't say so, and I know you've got the case that Senator Cook talked about, but you may or may not be aware of that when you have this problem facing you. And I personally, well, I think these amendments proposed by the bar are excellent, and I'm glad to see them getting rid of in Section 1, Sub 3, an erroneous reference. But I would personally think it might be very advantageous to a trial lawyer and in the long run to the appellate courts if you could file a supplemental statement later on if you found you needed it.
I wonder if we could have our counsel working with Ed work out some proposed amendments to the section.
I'd be happy to work with him.
Thank you, Ed. And you really do sweat when you think you're screwed up. You don't know if you're going to lose your whole case because of some technical.
Senator Keith Burns.
Can I raise a question that related?
Yeah.
Under 19.026, provides about 30 days to file your notice of appeal after the entry of the judgment appeal. What happens in practice when you send a judgment out for a judge to sign? Sometimes it'll sit on the desk for 3 and 4 weeks. You call his secretary every day to make sure, or you know the judgment is there, maybe you got a copy from the other attorney. You don't know when he's going to sign that judgment. And you have to call and call and call. You send a card out to ask him to send it back. A lot of times you go out there, the judgment is signed, the card's down in the clerk's office laying there in the box. I want to tell you about an experience I had. I represented a lady that found contempt of court, sentenced to 6 months in jail. Filed a murder that was so clear that the contempt charge had been thrown out. It was clear as a bell. Still, the judge sent her 6 months in jail. So I was very particularly concerned about the appeal. We called daily for 2 weeks. And no, he hadn't signed it. Then we call your appeals one day. I happened to be on the same court trying a case. I thought, well, I'm just going to check the file, make sure it's not true. This was the last day order in the file, signed by the judge, with the card I sent to them, sent back to me, found in the file, clipped to the top of the order. And I found out the next day that woman was on appeal. It was, we appealed it, was reversed. And so, but this is not quite a dramatic circumstance, this one, but it's just a great burden on you trying to find out when the judge will sign the judgment order. So I thought that you might say that after the judgment has been entered, and the clerk has thought up here, if you go up to 19023, that's not there in the bill, where it requires the party to the judgment desiring appeal by sending by mail and putting a certificate on it. They have mail, it requires the clerk to do that. And have the appeal time run from that time, but, you know, cutting it off after a year or something.
You'd have the clerk, put the burden on the clerk.
Which clerk?
The
clerk of the court, where Kate sits. I mean, that's what they're there for, you. So why shouldn't they mail it to everybody and file a certificate of mailing? They've got it all apart.
Well,
Well, doesn't the statute already require that notice be given of entry of judgment? Because I remember I succeeded in getting a final county judgment set aside a year ago on grounds that a party had not been served with notice of entry of judgment, and that's exactly what happened. The appeal time ran, and so we moved to set it aside on those grounds, and the court allowed it.
I think it may be that they have to send, when you submit it, the judgment to the court, they have to send a copy to the other side. I think that may be required.
That's what happened in this case. There was no such copy was sent.
Yeah, well, I got a copy of the judgment. So that is, I want to know when the judge signed it, because I can't appeal before he signed it.
I think that's a good idea.
Along the same line, I understand there's a recent Court of Appeals decision holding in criminal cases, at least in minor court criminal cases, that the judgment is entered when rendered orally from the bench and not when a subsequent written judgment order was entered, thereby filling somebody's appeal who measured his time from the entry of the written order rather than the oral order.
You mean they ruled that the judgment was entered when it was tabled?
This was in a minor court case that originated in a minor court, district court, went to circuit court. And in the district court, they held that judgment was entered as of that time.
Mm-hmm. The Court of Appeals held that when it was entered in the district court,
right.
The time ran from that.
Right.
Is it your desire to try to amend this bill?
No, I just think it should be amended.
Well, really, where it should be, Keith.
Well, this doesn't mean this makes reference to that.
This is the second, right?
All
right,
it does amend 19.123, and then you get down 19.126.
Well, Senator Burns, if I may comment, your point goes, it seems to me, in the entry of judgments generally. There are a lot of reasons you might want to know about the entry of a judgment besides wanting to appeal. You know, you want to levy execution or avoid it. Or whatever, wouldn't it be better to amend the judgment to the section of the code to provide that notice of entry of judgment shall be given?
Maybe. I think it's simple.
Maybe. But couldn't we include that in this bill?
Sure.
Let's include that in this bill, but just to add an amendment.
Section. Section 4.
Right? You want Mr. Dwyer to draft something like that? Anybody else?